The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's good to be back. Thank you very much, Charles Arthur, for holding the wheel while I was away in Hertfordshire, giving people a window into a world of serendipity. I'm back. And a Zemblanus encounter, yes, for those who are interested in serendipity, Zemblanity is the opposite of serendipity, with a virus has rendered my body ravaged by flu. Still, I've come into the studio today to share the joy and spread the contagion. I'm sure we'll have a totally new lineup next week as the rest of them fall like flies. On the program this week, Charles Arthur and I look at what will happen now that the axe has fallen at BlackBerry manufacturer's RIM. A swathe of inevitable job cuts, it seems, have blighted the flailing company. We find out what happened when the government implemented its new privacy scheme at the weekend, and we surf the exhaust of last week's Facebook IPO. All this from The Guardian's Tech Weekly. The beleaguered smartphone and tablet manufacturer Research in Motion, also known as RIM, has announced that it will be cutting 2,000 jobs from its global workforce by the beginning of the next quarter. Charles, this can't really come as a surprise, can it?
No, it's not. Torsten Hines, who's the new chief executive since around about February, has been saying that he would really be cutting back on the costs at the company. And the company has 16,500 people at the moment. This is going to be 2,000 off it, so that's quite a substantial, there's about 12% slim down. And there have been rumours coming from inside of what are called goodbye Thursdays, where people get called into the office and told, well, it's been very nice having you, now bye-bye.
Oh.
For the genius stuff. So
assuming at the end of the day, it's one of those things.
I don't know, actually. Carol Bartz, when Carol Bartz was at Yahoo, she used to fire them at breakfast, so you never know.
Well, you know, you don't need to get a work day out of somebody if you...
Exactly. Why spoil it? But as far as RIM goes, I think this is a very dangerous time. Another interesting development was that Patrick Spence, who used to be the head, the MD in the UK, who we spoke to around about the time of all the BlackBerry outages last year, who was promoted to global head of sales, is leaving, it turns out, to go to work at Sonos, the people who make the networked hi-fi gear. Now, I think it's really interesting if someone who's been promoted to global head of sales for an international smartphone manufacturer is choosing instead to go and work for a networked hi-fi company. You know, Sonos is a very promising company. They make, you know, really good stuff. I use it and enjoy it. But that's an interesting move. That says to me more, actually, than any number of, any sort of headline figure of job cuts could. That's a significant move. And I think that RIM is now entering a really dangerous phase because I don't think that it doesn't matter how great BlackBerry 10, the upcoming software is, that's not actually going to change anything for them. It doesn't change the game. It's not a new way of interacting with a device. It's nothing that you can't already get with an Android phone, an iPhone, a Windows phone. It just doesn't bring anything to the game. And I suspect that this is the point for RIM where they're either going to be looking at the end game or else they're going to be getting taken over.
Well, traditionally, in these kinds of circumstances, when you have a company who's starting to feel the pinch, it's the forward-looking employees, the research and development employees who get the axe, who get the pink slip at the end of the day, or at breakfast if they're at Yahoo. Do you think that RIM is doing it that way, or do you think that they're holding tight to their research and development, their boffins who may invent something beyond BlackBerry 10?
Well, the R&D people seem to be safe from the cuts, but equally, you know, they're looking at cutting people from operations, HR, but also sales. Well, if you're cutting people from sales is what brings the money in through the door. If you think that you can make more money from fewer people in sales, then generally, the story doesn't go that way.
It doesn't sound like
anything. The question is, how did you get so big and have such a big revenue previously, and yet now you're going to have fewer people and do it better? It's just not it's not a story that hangs together.
Was the trajectory of RIM one like you see in so many startups that implode when they get too excited and they hire too many people too quickly? Or
It hasn't grown too fast. The problem has simply been that Android has totally destroyed its market at the bottom end. All the little Android phones coming along, chewing away at that bottom end of the market like termites. It's just meant that there's been nothing underneath its feet. And at the top end, in the business side, Apple has come in at the iPhone. The iPhone has become, you know, a comparatively popular enterprise phone. It's taken away share from RIM there. So it's been hit at the high end, it's been hit at the low end. There's been nothing left in the middle for it. And it's not that it's had the startup problem of growing too fast. It was right-sized a few quarters ago. But two things happened. First of all, it made the colossal mistake of going for the playbook. The playbook was a Me Too tablet. It's cost it billions of dollars in inventory, in write-offs, and in lost time. They should have used that time to do something else. Instead, they thought that they'd catch on the coattails of Apple and do something that was really never well executed, never well planned, rather than thinking, what's the next stage in evolution of the smartphone? Where should we be in 3 years' time?
And what's the other thing? You said the first problem is that they invested in the playbook?
Yeah, it's the investment in playbook becomes the opportunity cost. So that's the first mistake. And the second mistake is not thinking where is smartphones, where's the experience going to be in 5 years' time?
It doesn't really bode well for this market if you can have one failure, i.e. the playbook, and have your company eradicated and destroyed in such a monumental way. What does this say about what's going on in this industry? Is it a one-hit wonder, a one-fail pony, you know, it's all or nothing, zero-sum?
No, I think that RIM overbalanced because it really threw everything into the playbook. And it was such a colossally bad mistake. It was such a failure, to be honest, of vision. HP had a similar sort of idea with the touchpad, and that costed $1 billion straight out. It costed $3 billion, really, if you cost in the acquisition of Palm, the write-offs on the device, and the final write-offs on the staff. But HP is a big enough company to come back from it. RIM just can't bear that sort of weight of, you know, roughly again about $2 billion or so in terms of lost opportunity, write-offs, inventory costs. So the lesson is more that you shouldn't be thinking about what your rival was working on 5 years ago, which is the case with Apple. You should be thinking about where you want to be in 5 years' time. And I've got to say, all credit to Google. I think that they're right on the correct part of the curve with Google Glasses. That's absolutely where it's going to be.
Well, last weekend, changing tack, the government implemented a new law that demands that UK businesses obtain informed consent from website visitors when browsing the web. So the first time people visit a site, they'll be asked to opt in to having a cookie placed in their browser, a little piece of code that allows its owners to track where you're going and what you are doing when you're online. Charles, this seems to have come out of nowhere.
It feels like it has, but actually, yeah. Among website designers and agencies, it's been all the talk. It's been all the rage. The ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, which has been given charge of implementing the EU's Privacy Directive, has been going on about it for more than a year. There's been consultations with the government, with the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Ed Vasey has been trying to get the ICO to take a soft line on it, not to implement it too heavily. The idea is that you shouldn't be tracked without your consent, that you should be opting in. And some sites have implemented it, some sites have not. Some sites have been sort of implementing it. A lot of it comes down to what the ICO's advice has been. And they had some advice back in December, which was, yeah, you really need to be telling everyone what you're doing with cookies, because you can't assume that because people have done something or other that they're consenting. You can't assume implied consent, as it was called. Last Thursday, the PDF with their advice was altered. They changed it on Thursday, which then was published on the Friday, the day before the cookie implementation had to go into force.
And what was it changed from to?
It was changed to say that implied consent could be assumed in certain circumstances.
So is this basically just because there are so few sites that have actually complied that they don't want to deal with a deluge of complaints, so they're kind of you know, they're getting a
well. It certainly makes it easier for the ICO to police it, because they can look at it and say, yeah, no, that's okay by our rules, because we've watered them down. The penalty for infringing this the EU Privacy Directive goes up to £500,000. So you can see that sites might be keen to get it right. But equally, the fact that the ICO only changed its guidance on this on the Thursday night, and then blogged about it on the Friday. They didn't issue a press release. I checked with them. They said, no, we put it on our blog, and you know, people have been, and we tweeted about it as well. And people. So I said, okay, so how many people came to your blog? And they said, we don't know, because we don't keep analytics cookies on it.
Otherwise, I'd have to ask if you wanted to visit the site. So actually, this is an interesting question. I have browsed the web today. I have done, you know, some pretty basic browsing. I cleared my cookies, as I do on a regular basis, and my cache. And I haven't been asked by any of the sites that I regularly visit if I'm okay with the fact that a cookie will now reside in my browser.
Including Guardian? Yeah, including, yeah. Okay. The Guardian does have an interaction.
There is a chocolate chip cookie.
I've had people tweeting me and saying, yeah, I really like the way that the Guardian implements it. So nope. I think it differs for different sites, but I do know of one site, at least one about T.E. Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom guy, so to speak. They've taken the website offline because they say we can't be sure that we'll be in compliance with the EU Privacy Directive, and we don't want to be in the line of £500,000 fine.
So if a user like myself drops into a site and decides that I don't want to be followed, but I'm not asked, how can I alert the ICO that the website hasn't complied?
Well, the first thing to do actually would be to change the settings in your browser so that you never get any cookies set. It'll make your life quite interesting, where interesting means you'll be playing hit the accept button all the time, and most of the web won't work very well for you. But hey, you won't be tracked. And the other thing would be to report the site to the Information Commissioner's office. I wouldn't hold your breath at them turning up very quickly and handing out a £500,000 fine.
It is interesting that that the interesting part of your comment there, because many privacy advocates say that if you want to be private, then just, you know, turn off your cookies and browse the web anonymously. But as you say, a whole bunch of the web just simply won't work. So not being tracked is not an option anymore. So is this directive actually the best solution to get the opt-in? We may have a few hiccups initially, but is this not the best solution for moving forward so that we can use a web that functions and serves us correctly?
What you really want is a sort of an anonymized version of cookies which don't collect personal or personalizable information, but it's really hard to know when that information is going to be or how it can be cross-matched, how it can build up a picture of you, whether you go across different services which then allow a picture to be gained together. I mean, I suppose the ideal would actually be one where you only have particular cookies set on particular sites. And many browsers do have an option, which is don't allow third-party cookies to be set. And that's actually a pretty good compromise. It means that sites like Amazon, which uses cookies, for example, for shopping trolleys, and, you know, cookies and shopping trolleys are the essential use because the web is stateless. It doesn't know from one point to another what buttons you've pressed. So cookies are a good way of knowing where you are along the track of my shopping experience, for example. So not allowing third-party cookies is a good way to go about it. The way that this is being implemented, you know, the whole EU Privacy Directive, feels a bit like overkill, and it's really annoyed a lot of people for a long time. Sometimes the EU gets it right, and sometimes, you know, as with this, it just overplays its hand a bit.
And is this valid for any website at all, or is this only...
No, it's only European ones or those which have operations in the EU.
Next in this week's news, music services abound and offer you streaming, cloud storage, and downloads, but a music service tied to a manufacturer's hardware. Well, that just sounds like Apple. Well, not any longer. If Samsung have anything to do with it, Charles, you spoke with TJ Kang, who is the SVP from the Media Service Team at the Media Solutions Center at Samsung, and Darren Sui from MSpot about their new partnership. What is it?
Well, Samsung, which is best known for its smartphones, where it has about 25% of the entire smartphone market, and all its electronics, where it makes everything from the DRAM chips right up to the PCs, now owns a company called MSpot, which does subscription and a la carte services. But the whole idea that TJ Kang is expressing is that Samsung wants to get into doing content, because content is where the really good experiences are if you're using hardware. TJ, tell me about what Samsung's plans are in the content space, because the acquisition of MSpot, which is a music provider, is intended to give Samsung more presence in the music space. But what's the thinking behind that?
You know, Samsung's known for the excellent hardware that we create, but not much for the content service. But we are actually making a lot of investment in the area. We think that with the smartphones and tablets, content is as important as the hardware.
So in the case of your Media Solutions Group, you've got 1,000 people. You've been going for 4 years. That's a very rapid growth. Mm-hmm. You said that you think content is the important thing. Mm-hmm. What are the examples that you can point to there? And what do you think the benefits are for Samsung of doing that?
Well, smartphone, especially the tablet, is more than just a single-purpose device, depending on what service you use. It could give you a totally different experience, new experience to the users. So we want to create the whole user experience that takes advantage of the beautiful Super AMOLED screen that devices come adorned with, and the content and the service that will actually take best advantage of the hardware.
With these, are these going to be cross-platform? So, for example, is it going to be, you said smartphones and tablets, is it for the smart TVs as well?
Yes.
And what about across operating systems? Because Samsung makes lots of different operating systems. You have Android devices, you have Windows Phone, you have Bada. Will these function across all those three as well?
Yes. Yeah, many of the services that we create in Media Solutions Center do support all of the operating systems, including PC. Many of these services, start out just as an application or service customized for Android, but we keep expanding the platform support to include all of the operating systems that our company supports.
So is this a way to rather like Apple does, to lock people into Samsung hardware? If someone has a Samsung phone now, say, and if they then move to a different make of Android phone, mm-hmm. will they be able to bring their content with them from the Samsung division or not?
Depends on the service. We hope to make the service available on most major operating platforms.
But so, for example, if someone has bought a lot of music from mm-hmm. MSpot or has a subscription with MSpot mm-hmm. and they shift to a different Android brand, mm-hmm. will they be able to bring that subscription with them?
Yeah, that's the goal.
How does that give you an advantage? Because it's a very narrow margin doing things like video, audio, ebooks even. They're not great money makers. If you let people shift to other brands, other platforms even, how do you retain that value to yourself, all the effort that you've spent in getting it there?
The reason why we are doing these services is that we want to create the best possible experience. So that's why instead of working with third-party solutions, white-label solutions, we are doing this internally and we are making the acquisitions. So there will always be, I think, a difference in the service that you experience on our devices. Even if the same service is available on other platforms, there will be something more.
Darren, what's the view, having been at MSpot, where in effect you still are, but it's now part of Samsung, how do you see the value in having extra content to a platform generally?
Oh, we're very excited about being part of Samsung. One of the things that's with MSpot is that we focus pretty much just in the U.S., a little bit in Canada, and now we have the opportunity to work with Samsung to go global with the service, so that's very appealing. We think that the music experience or media in general could be fantastic if you have really tight integration between hardware and the service itself.
So having a gigantic brand like Samsung behind you must be very helpful. But even so, music licensing across different territories tends to be a real rat's nest, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think this is part of the reasons why Samsung has decided that it needs to own a music service, because if you look at some of the, you know, other services, I do not know of any subscription service, for example, that has true global reach. You know, they may be on a few countries here and there in the different continents, but from Samsung's perspective, we need to be in every single country that Samsung's in, which I heard that it's around 145 countries. So it's pretty big. And because nobody is able to offer that, Samsung decided that this is something that we need to do ourselves. So part of our group's charter is, in addition to building the service on the technical side, we need to go out there and get licensing too.
How would you describe the difference between Apple's iTunes store, the music store, and what you do?
You know, we sort of created the service with this concept of all-in-one. We feel that, you know, different people, even the same person, would enjoy music differently at different times. There are avid music collectors that may have a lot of music they've collected over the years. In that case, you know, we have a scan and match locker service that's great for that. Allows you to free your music from your PC up to the cloud. But then, you know, there are also users that may want to, you know, try and sample different things, ever-changing tastes. And for that, you know, we've got a humongous library, a catalog of different music that you can use on an unlimited basis, like a subscription service. And then lastly, there are also people that, you know, enjoy a more of a lean-back experience where they want to be fed. And in that particular case, we have a really good set of programs that's curated by our own internal DJs. They're genre-based radio stations, as well as we have a personal radio service that you can enter an artist name or a song name, and automatically we create your own personal playlist for you. So as you can tell,
a bit like Lost FM.
Exactly. And then lastly, we also have just a music store that if you want to just buy music, you can get that from us too. So we really think that with this particular service, there's no reason for a user to go anywhere else, that everything could be sort of taken care of from a single service. And by the way, these are all, they're not just discrete services as well. They all work with each other so that the more you use one, it makes the other better in the form of we have a great recommendation and discovery engine. So, for example, if you list, you know, we can tell what songs you have in your locker, and then we can curate radio stations for you or actually recommend different catalogs and songs for you from our massive catalog.
So, TJ, when you look at how people use media, how they listen to media or read media or watch media when it comes to, you know, books, music, video, you've talked about these three platforms. You have smartphones, you have tablets, you have smart TV. Where do you see the biggest opportunities?
I think it really depends on the media types. For music, we believe that the biggest the user base will be in the, you know, smartphones. And for ebook, I mean, it will be the tablet will be the, you know, the major market. And for video, it will be, you know, smart TV and the tablet and some smartphones, especially some of our smartphones, you know, sport pretty large screen, Galaxy Note, right? So the video viewing experience on those devices are, you know, pretty good. Music, I think, will probably be appreciated in all of devices, including our, you know, refrigerator. Some of our refrigerators, you know, come with 7-inch LCD screens. My wife likes to, you know, listen to music while she's, you know, working in the kitchen. And in that case, our, you know, lean-back personalized radio experience will be perfect. The, you know, or the playlist that she created on her, you know, smartphone will just, you know, transfer seamlessly to the refrigerator. And
I think being able to say my smart playlist is on my refrigerator just tells us that South Korea is living in the future. Hardware companies have traditionally been really great at making hardware, and they're very good at doing all the contracts involved there. When they then try to get into content, the content business, they find that it has all these really strange contracts, regions, time limits, artists who want to cut, producers who want to cut, publishers who want to cut, and it can hold them back. How have you found the experience in the Media Solutions Group of doing the shift from a hardware company, which is doing the sort of the soft side, the content side.
This is definitely something, you know, new that, you know, we are learning, and we've been learning in the last, you know, couple of years. I think one thing that helping us right now compared to pure service-based, you know, companies is that our initial mandate is, you know, we don't have to make huge, you know, profit from the content services. Our, you know, initial goal is to make the, you know, experience of consuming these contents on our devices, you know, the best, you know, possible.
TJ Kang and Darren Tsui from MSpot and from Samsung, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Facebook IPO has generated countless column inches as the social network failed to achieve a buoyant float in the course of its first week on the stock market. Charles, I've been on my deathbed, frankly, over the past week, and so I've only heard fevered rumors of what's been going on. So tell me the story. Tell me the story of the Facebook IPO.
The story is sell high, buy low, which basically is what happened. So a lot of Facebook stock was sold at $38. It had a little bit of a pop on the first day to sort of 43 or so. Quickly started falling, hit the $38 floor when all the underwriters, who are the people who have promised to Facebook that they will buy the stock on the first day, all piled in to keep the price at $38. Then when it came to the next Monday, everyone sold. And the stock has hit the sort of $30 floor with a bit of a bump, had a bit of a dead cat bounce, as they call it. So it's around about $30, $31 now, meaning that Facebook is sitting on a $16 billion pile of money, which it got from selling all those shares at $38. A bunch of underwriters are sitting there feeling rather sad for themselves because the ones who had to step in to buy at $38 as the stock was heading down are now nursing substantial losses because they weren't told about the expectation that Facebook wasn't going to do as well as it did.
Well, I don't think anybody was really. It was all fueled by rumor and hot air, wasn't it? I mean, this is
like any IPO.
Yeah, exactly.
Really.
Like absolutely any IPO. So why were we, holding our bated breath on the Facebook? What, you know, was this the golden child? Was this going to tell us that technology was okay and we would, you know, ascend into some kind of future of glory and social network nirvana?
Well, the thing about Facebook was that they upped the number of shares that they sold because they said there was really big retail demand, which seems to be more like lots of investment banks wanted to be selling the shares because they thought there was going to be a pop. But a pop being where the stock rises very rapidly in the first day. So all the underwriters who've bought the shares basically can sell some more of them on. Instead, it didn't do very much because there was a lot of doubt about the number of shares being sold, about how viable Facebook's business would be long term, and people just didn't think that much of it. It's interesting to look back at Google. When Google floated in sort of summer of 2004, there was a lot of doubt about it. People said, I'm not so sure this is going to do so well. You know, what's the stock really about? The stock has increased enormously since then. I mean, it'll be interesting to look back in a year, 5 years, on where Facebook stock is and what has happened to it since then. Because when you look at Google, all the really interesting stuff at Google has actually happened since it floated. So, for example, YouTube, Android, you name it, pretty much any of the interesting things has actually happened since it went public. So I think the same is ahead of Facebook. And, for example, there's some talk that Facebook is going to build a smartphone. It'll probably fork Android. It'll build its own stack. There's some rumors about it buying the Opera browser, which is the most widely used browser in the Far East. It actually figures very hard in mobile browsing statistics. So there's interesting things still to come from Facebook, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at when you compare the two, which is quite a dangerous comparison because it is kind of apples and oranges when you look at the two of them.
Kind of, except they're both advertising.
Well, I suppose, but they
targeted
they also,
advertising,
and they're also very much about sort of surfing the web in terms of relevance and value.
Where, well, yeah, it's true. You know, turn the internet off, and neither of them exist.
Well, but Google has a real function because it helps you to navigate. It helps you to surf it because it's effectively the Dewey Decimal System of the web. Whereas what is Facebook's function?
Connect you with your friends.
Doesn't the web do that anyway?
Not necessarily. It doesn't do it in a sort of an ordered way, maybe. And it doesn't let you determine who your friends are in the way that Facebook can.
Is Facebook, I mean, Google is potentially interchangeable, except now it has this incredible, you know, it has an incredible stack of cached sites. Its existing library makes it quite a unique property.
But it's an interesting question to look at whether search is fungible now. Can you just swap search engines and get the same sort of experience? Or is Google the only one where you get a particular... Yeah, it's quite an interesting experience just to try a different browser on your desktop for a day and do different searches. And, you know, to try the same on your mobile phone, try a different search engine on your phone. And then you say, well, okay, so how fungible is Facebook? Can you just swap to a different social network? And do you get the same effect? And that's the sort of question which tends to lead you to which of the companies is the more valuable over the long period.
Well, and therefore, using that kind of test, Facebook is a pretty valuable property because so many people are on Facebook. Its network is what keeps it alive. Its social graph is what it traded on. Yet it doesn't seem to have mattered to people who are investing.
But that's stocks. Stock markets are not entirely rational. You know, the thing is that they only start to see the value in the shares once Facebook starts to report its figures and says, you know, now we made this many $1 billion. Then they start to say, oh, this is a great stock. I'm going to pile into it. You know, what happens on the first day or the first week actually is all done with no visibility of Facebook's future at all, or even its sort of sensible past. All that you know about is how the meeting of demand and supply went on the first few days after the IPO, but that doesn't actually tell you anything about Facebook's fundamental business or about its future business.
Thank you, Charles. And that is it for this week. Next week, we have an exclusive hands-on with a new Nintendo Wii U as the team reports from the floor at the annual Computer Games Consumer Fiesta, the Electronics Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles. I won't be there. I'm going to be in Singapore. However, I will be with you in spirit. Until next Tuesday, thank you very much to Charles Arthur for his always sterling contributions and to Jason Phipps for another week of expert producing. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.